Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata's sunglasses. If he's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. Today on our program, Desiree Helligers and Robin White talk with Shelley Sansosi and Holly St. Pierre about the community health impacts of months-long flooding on the Acton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota and indigenous-led efforts to collect and transport supplies from the Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area. We include today with another segment of our Left on the Law series, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker review the bankruptcy case of PG&E underway in San Francisco, which has, consequently, caused them to attempt to prevent forest fires by shutting off electricity to millions of customers. Weeding off today, Bill Resnick interviews Lisa Loving, longtime editor of the Scanner paper in Portland, and recently news director here at KBOO. She's worked with many an aspiring journalist on local stories, and from this experience, she wrote the book Street Journalism. Bill and Lisa discuss the craft and importance of local journalism.
Hi, Lisa Loving. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Lisa Loving has been a fixture of Portland social justice and left media for many years. Though of European heritage, she added to The Scanner, which reports on the inner city and also on the once Afro-American neighborhoods. She's also served as news director at this radio station quite honorably for many years. And in both positions, she worked with young people and those without formal journalism training to go out and get local stories and report on local events. So, in fact, she taught a lot of people about gathering, distilling, writing news. And with that experience, she wrote the book, very readable, quite profound in many ways, the book Street Journalist, Understand and Report the News in Your Community. What's street journalism, Lisa? Why did you write the book? And give us a little sense of the content.
With my publisher, came up with this term, street journalism, just to differentiate it from the corporate sector journalism that we see. You know, we're just trying to define what it means when everyday people pick up the tools of journalism and start reporting on our communities. And with the mega decline in media of all kinds, there's not one single solitary stable media outlet anywhere in America today, except maybe the Wall Street Journal, but who knows? The whole point of it is that we need to find a different avenue for bringing journalists online and for teaching people about what information is than our journalism departments in the universities. Some of our very best and brightest people will never have the money to go to a university, wouldn't even have the resources to get in if they had the money. The point of this book is basically bringing these tools so that we have people on the ground that are actually collecting information. That's the most important thing. But sort of the secret sauce, the backstory of street journalists is literally teaching people what information really is so that as consumers, we can kick the tires on something that we're reading or watching or listening to and test whether it's valid or whether it's true or not. We hear so much about fake news, but I think the bigger issue is real information that people don't want to accept. So there's, you know, information in here for people that want to do journalism. It's really great for teenagers, but also it's just tools people can use to understand the journalism that they're immersed in. So both of those things I think are important.
In the introduction to the book and throughout the book, you talk about street journalism as the heir of a very long tradition of people talking to one another and assessing the world around them and bringing them news from afar. There was a time when cities were really quite isolated, except for some of the storytellers and the how do you pronounce it?
Commedia dell'arte, traveling comedy troupes. I sort of allude to that, and the
griots.
The griots in Africa also. As human beings, we've always been hungry for knowledge and information. For some people, that's storytelling. But really, it's all about getting the information that you need to live your life today. I mean, one of the reasons I put that in there is that we don't even think about news or Dan Rather or NPR or whatever. We just assume that's something that we've always had. But we haven't exactly come together in these corporate entities to share information. A super fantastic source on this is a book by Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now! Called Media for All the People. It's a fantastic history. It's actually a reference book of media in the United States. And a lot of people have no idea where their news came from. You really should pick up that book, by the way. It's wonderful. They have it at the library. But I think one of the reasons why I think it's important to bring this up is that we don't even know where we're going to be getting news in 10 years. We have no idea. And as I said, so many outlets are literally crumbling.
The old media is crumbling. In fact, cable itself is part of old media. We've done a lot better, actually, than the Oregonian, for example.
It's because we're so close to the ground. It's because we're so grassroots.
Yeah.
Facebook is the new media. Well, they don't know what they're doing either. Facebook is the tail that wagged the dog. And Google, too. Google just changed its algorithms. Facebook is going to change theirs, too. And I think that the most important thing for us to know is the more our tools change, the more what we do stays the same. And we were just kind of arguing, me and you, Bill, about like gossip or information. You know, what is it?
Is gossip journalism?
How do you tell if somebody's telling a story? Is that the same as information? In this book, I just really want to establish that if you're not fact-checking, it's not journalism. I just have to put my foot down on that. One of my favorite parts of this book is the fact-checking chapter where I talk about heuristics. Heuristics are a social psychological term for the shortcuts that our brains take when we're trying to make decisions in tough situations. And I like to think of them as brain farts. You could be a very intelligent person, but actually have mega shortcomings in how you look at the world around you. Once we know these things, we can learn from them and compensate. Yeah.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole. I'm talking to Lisa Loving, a distinguished career as news director of KABU for a time. How many years was it?
It's been a few years, I've been a volunteer and a producer here since 1990.
What you're saying, it seems to me, throughout the book, if you want to be a street journalist or just be a person in a meeting of people in the street or whatever it is, at the neighborhood get-together, or even more, the neighborhood newspaper, there are now neighborhood blogs, right? So many ways that people communicate now and together in groups, right? There's I live in whatever neighborhood it is, Sunnyside. But I think there's a Sunnyside group that talks neighbor to neighbor about 33rd Street and how do we deal with the traffic and what about all that loud noise and how do we fit in? What about our neighborhood association and how should we feel about it? All of those issues, it seems to me, come up just in blogs as neighbors speak to one another.
I'm concerned you might be talking about Nextdoor, which is a vortex of wrong information, honestly. So many of these digital platforms were designed for somebody to make money somewhere. They're not necessarily designed for you to become informed about what's actually happening around you. And Nextdoor freaks me out because people aggress each other on there. But if somebody lost their dog, if you lost your dog, Nextdoor is the only place you're going to go. That lost dog's going to be found within a short period of time.
But you can enter Nextdoor and, in fact, make sense. You can challenge some of the stuff that is being said. I agree that you may not convert people instantly, but there are so many opportunities for street journalists to, having fact-checked and figure out what they're talking about and being confident that at least they can ask important questions about the whatever other people have said.
I'm going to dispute you with that for a minute. I think that examples like Nextdoor, which is like a freewheeling, people posting things neighbor by neighbor on this platform. I don't think that's journalism at all. And you could get rid of the word street. What we're really just talking about is journalism. Yeah. I think the point of reaching for journalism, and there are more and more interesting online outlets that are distributed through emails, so you can't see them. There's quite a few of them now. There's not even any place to find them, really, which is bothers me. There's one called Bridgeliner that's coming out every day. It's an email that comes out every day. It's actually super interesting. So what you're looking for when you're looking for an informed perspective is people that actually have processes for checking the information in the discussion that's happening.
Well, I sort of interpret you and the book differently, I have to say. I think what you're saying to people is join the conversation, but be very careful about your point of view and thinking about it and making sure that your point of view, there's a lot of evidence for it. And look at the evidence on the other side and evaluate it. It seems to me you're asking street journalists, however wide you want to make that definition, you're asking people to be really careful about what they're saying. And you never know how large your audience is going to get on Nextdoor or any of these other things, because you can have influence, and it's a moral responsibility to use that influence in ways that actually inform other people rather than just sort of excite them and then find commodities for them to buy. There's a lot of that that goes on in the guise of news. It seems to me that's what you're saying.
I mean, I guess I respect that. You're saying, you know, participate in a conversation. I guess for me, I more want people to understand the difference between what is information and what is not. I love the part of this book that literally defines what information is, because it's not very obvious and it's not a straight line either. In the book, I use this example of police reports. Anything that is said in a police report is technically considered to be information, even if it's not accurate. And it's a court case about whatever happened in that police incident that further defines what is considered to be truth or factual. So if a judge finds, for example, that a police officer is innocent of some sort of, aggressive act, technically, that's a fact. Although we would dispute it and we would say, I don't really believe that that's a fact. So then it's for us to come up with some other perspective about why that's not a fact. But see, truth is a pretty murky place. I'm just saying.
It's a very murky place. And as you point out again in your introduction, history is written by the victors.
Unless we start writing stuff down.
Unless we start.
Yeah, straight up.
But there are other sources of information. So we're really in a struggle. In the United States, it's become so ever-present, this struggle about what really is happening. Is climate change real? How threatening is it?
Yeah.
Of course, it's influenced enormously by the people with money.
Yeah.
On the other hand, street journalists can get into that conversation, and as the evidence begins getting more and more clear, people change their minds. And it seems to me what we're talking about is this vast international now. We have a global community that is bathed in different stories and different information. But street journalists can, in fact, influence that.
You can even get rid of the word street and say journalists, everyday people. And one of the interesting projects, as we talk about what is truth and how do everyday people gain the tools of journalism to actually make sure that the public record has real information in it. There's this interesting project, I believe it's happening in Chicago, where a newsroom is paying everyday people to do nothing but go out, record municipal meetings, and then transcribe them and bring them back to the publication. If you had any idea how few meetings are covered by journalists anymore, it's shocking as hell, Bill. No. We don't even know. And this thing about the example of the neighborhood associations and what is it, policy 3.96, which is the thing that's going to change the nature of neighborhood associations.
Right.
I was diving deep into my Twitters like last week, and I found where the Oregonian reporter that was covering the very first meetings about that in June, he actually tweeted, I'm at a municipal meeting of a government body, and there's a note on the wall that says, whatever's discussed here stays here. I don't think so. This is a public meeting, he said. He didn't even write that into a story, okay? I don't think anyone's even covered that, that those first meetings actually had signs that were on the wall. Someone from the city staff taped that on the wall that said, you're not allowed to talk about what's happening here. That's a slap in the face. If we even just had people that could go to the meetings, all the independent police review meetings or whatever, and just record what happens and then transcribe them and put them in a place, that's an amazing service. And that's kind of what I'm talking about. Well, that's what we need.
There's so much room for learning, for reading, for studying, for talking to other people. Now, it's harder and harder to make a living now, and there's less and less free time, unfortunately, for most people. Here we are in the richest country in the world, and everybody is running around crazily, and they're precarious. It's an absurdity.
You could even say it's capitalism.
Of our system.
That is the actual conspiracy. It is the economic system. It's its own conspiracy.
Yes. But people have less time, unfortunately, to, quote, volunteer and the rest of it. You know, a society is not built on wage labor. It's built mostly on people who are doing things for themselves and others, like child rearing. No one pays for child rearing now. It's not an economic category. But boy, if you don't have child rearing, you disappear from the planet very quickly. The sort of the things that keep society together are not paid.
I think that we're heading for some kind of gigantic collapse. I don't know what it looks like. You can't have this many people living in the street without a mega collapse of society, for real. And that's not really slowing down.
Among other things, yes. And committing suicide at higher rates. Really high rates, even among the police, apparently.
Oregon has one of the highest suicide rates in the nation. This is an interesting one because for the past 2 years, all the media outlets in the state of Oregon, a confederation of media outlets has gotten together to cover that same story all at the same time. And you see where the people that are left at the media outlets, they care. The people that are left at the Oregonian, I'm going to put this out. The Oregonian hasn't been a daily in years, but the people that are left there are some of the best and brightest, honestly. And they have other genius friends that are scattered all throughout the United States. Nicole Hannah Jones used to be a reporter at the Oregonian. She just made a mega splash at the New York Times with the 1619 Project. She's a winner of a genius grant, and that's the person who got away. We have organized our communities around politics for generations, but we have to start organizing our communities around information.
In a previous conversation, we talked about your book, and I said, it really seems interesting. He says, oh, no, it's just a cookbook of how to do journalism. In fact, your book's not just about cooking up some basic meal. It's really spiced with all sorts of ideas of human obligation, questions of truth, questions of moral responsibility, and it sort of has a trajectory towards social justice. You're asking people to exercise their better selves and learn things and talk to others about it. It's a very useful book for that reason. I think you're asking people to be engaged in the world in a way that's informed and moral. And that's an achievement, Lisa. I think you should be proud of your book and not just call it a cookbook. And you get the last word.
I say cookbook because really it's a very short book. It's just easy to follow. It's just tips and tricks. It's not a bunch of bloviating opinion pieces. But the thing is, the hallmark in journalism today that you may not realize is that whatever you do, it needs to be relational, right? Not transactional. So everything you do is building relationships with the people you talk to, building relationships with your community around you, and not, hey, if you talk to me now, I'll put your story on page one. That's transactional. Community journalism has always brought people together. We used to do it all the time. And if I could say one more thing about that, and I'm not going to get all my feelings, people forget that kids used to be the cornerstone of the newspaper industry. People forget that. And I mean, for more than 100 years, newspapers were they were sold by children to their neighbors. They were delivered by children in their neighborhoods. One of the biggest labor strikes in the history of the United States was waged by children who lived on the streets of New York City against Randolph Hearst. It was called the newspaper strike of, what was it, 1910 or what, 1890? Seriously, people forget that. And whatever you're doing with journalism right now, if you're not including kids, you're screwing up. You've got to bring them in because they're the ones who are going to figure out where we're going to be getting news 10 years from now. And I'm just saying, invest in our kids. Bring them into the information economy in a way that is impactful for them. Make it part of their lives.
There's journalism everywhere. I invite people to come to KBOO and learn about journalism and read the book by Lisa Loving and appreciate its moral core. Lisa Loving, thanks so much for talking to us today.
It's a joy, Bill. Thanks for having me.
I sell the morning paper, sir. My name is Jimmy Brown. Everybody knows I am the news boy of the town. You'll hear me yelling Morning Star as I run along the street. I have no hat upon my head, no shoes upon my feet. I have no hat upon my head, no shoes upon my feet. I'm awful cold and hungry, sir. My clothes are torn and thin. I wander about from place to place, my daily bread to win. Never mind, sir, how I look. Don't look at me and frown. I sell the morning paper, sir. My name is Jimmy Brown.
And this is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Old Mo Variety Hour. The song you just heard was Jimmy Brown, the Newsboy by Max Wiseman. Now Old Mo's Desiree Hellingers and Robin White speak by phone with Shelley Sansosi and Holly St. Pierre about the community health impacts of month-long flooding on the Acton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota and Indigenous-led efforts to collect and transport supplies from the Portland-Vancouver metropolitan area. As of this moment, we have not been able to raise Shelley on the line, but we will keep trying throughout the interview. Desiree and Robin?
Yeah, good morning. So I'm here today in the studio with fellow Mole, Lakota Cheyenne activist Robin White, and we're speaking this morning by phone, we hope at least, with Yankton Sioux tribal members Holly St. Pierre, who's in Kalama, Washington, and who's already on the line. And we're reaching out still to try to get Shelley Sansosi in South Dakota, also on the line. And we're speaking about the months-long flooding on the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. Holly St. Pierre is an activist and trauma counselor, and Shelley Sansosi is vice chair of the White Swan community, which is heavily impacted by the flooding. She is also director of tribal employment of the Tribal Employment Rights Office. So I just want to, first of all, refer our listeners to some of the excellent reporting that DNA Yankton journalist Jacqueline Keeler has done on the flooding. And note that Shelley Sansosi was also interviewed on October 10th by Jacqueline Keeler and Paul Rowland on Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. So we're going to be posting links to those stories when we post this segment online later on in the week. So the extreme flooding really began with a bomb cyclone in March and with unusually heavy rains that have continued and which may represent the new normal under climate change. And so, Holly, I know that originally, we were kind of looking to Shelley, who's on the ground in South Dakota, to provide us with a little bit of context on the situation. But I'm wondering if you could maybe fill us in a little bit on what's been going on.
Yeah, I sure can. I do have several family members that live there and have been personally impacted by the flood. Father was born in that community. And so just, you know, keeping in contact, you know, really close contact with Shelley, like I have been. I know that one of the biggest problems is that the water quality, of course, has been impacted. It's been a lot of confusion. There hasn't been good communication about whether the water has been safe for drinking, you know, washing dishes, bathing, all of that. There has been E. coli detected in the water at one point. So they're living with that. You know, I guess probably the best kind of image I could give of it, it would be, you know, just to imagine living amongst, you know, feet of standing water, you know, for over 7 months. That's infected now by all kinds of bacteria. And you know, also there is some effects of algae bloom. That's the runoff from neighboring farms. And so people, children, as well as, you know, their parents, have been affected by breathing problems. There have been a few families that have had to leave because the children have, you know, are on nebulizer treatments due to the standing water and the mold spores, you know, within their homes. They're also, you know, with winter coming on, many of them are unable to turn on their furnaces because they have been warned about mold spores in the furnaces. And so we've been trying to get heaters out there and blankets. Since they don't have a central heating supply at this point, many of them. You know, there's a main road, the main highway that they use in and out of town to get to services, to get to school, to get into medical treatment because several members are on dialysis, several residents, has been flooded out essentially since March. It's my understanding that the governor did pay quite a bit of money to have that highway raised 4 feet. However, in September, they experienced another quite big rainstorm. It was 11 inches in 24 hours, which flooded out the road, the main road again. And so they're all using a somewhat unsafe, very rutted dirt road to try to get into the services and get around. So that's they're blocked quite a bit from transportation. Even delivery trucks that have been bringing in supplies are now sometimes refusing to use that road to get in. So that's going on. We had a scare yesterday because the community center where Shelley and several volunteers are helping to feed the community every day, we were thinking that was now flooding. That community center is vital right now to keeping people's spirits up, you know, helping them have a place to go, can eat, because many of their homes smell like sewage. They don't want to eat in their homes, you know, understandably. And so, but we did find out that that was thankfully kind of a false alarm. There was a rain gutter that was broken and was, they found out, was pouring into the community center. And so they got that fixed. And it's my understanding everything's, you know, cool now, so that we were breathing a big sigh of relief last night when we found that out, because, you know, it's where people are gathering. You know, they can go and receive support from one another, you know, pick up emergency supplies. So, I mean, that's kind of the main issues that a lot of the residents are experiencing at this point. And I guess just to give some really important background history, the White Swan community is currently located in Lake Andes on the reservation. However, they were not always located at this current place. They were, and the place where my father was born was much closer down, closer to the Missouri River. However, that area is now flooded due to the building of several dam projects, the Fort Randall Dam. And so at that time in the early 50s, the Army Corps of Engineers came in and condemned the land to take it for purposes of building the Fort Randall Dam and several other dams. My great-grandmother and many other families at that time lost their land and were forced to relocate at that time with very little help. Just kind of had to disperse to wherever they could find places to go. And so now they're currently, the White Swan community is currently located at Lake Andes, and, you know, being flooded out and being generally ignored by the governor. And if they don't receive relief, you know, within somewhat short period of time, they will be forced to relocate once again and just kind of perpetuate, you know, the sad history that has been the history of Natives, you know, throughout the foundation of this country.
And that scenario is a fairly familiar one to people in this region, because it kind of mirrors the situation with the Dalles Dam in Oregon. And in both cases, you know, promises of replacement housing were never fulfilled. And also interesting to note that the Fort Randall Dam is part of a kind of complex of hydroelectric powers, power
yes.
plants, five of them in total, but it's one of the largest. And, you know, a 1999 court document indicated that at that point, the dam was generating more than $1.5 billion a year in hydropower for the federal government. And so, you know, the fact that that land has been such a lucrative source of, you know, money and hydropower, and yet none of that compensation is going to the tribal members, ought to give us all kind of pause. And I just want to interject here, too, that the tribe has been asking the governor to call out the National Guard, and the governor has so far been refusing.
Yeah. It's very curious because the National Guard is located, I believe it's about 20 miles away in Wagner. And the statement that was put out to the tribe was that, you know, they had many other resources that they could tap into, and that the National Guard was only to be used as a last resort. And I don't know. I'm just incredulous at that, because I mean, if people are living with their homes smelling like sewage and no heater, I don't know how much more of a last resort there has to be. I don't know how much more dire the conditions have to be.
There was also a study done, I think, in the last few years of Rosebud Sioux Reservation and one other reservation in the state that indicated that life expectancy for people on those two reservations was 21 years shorter than other communities in the state. And so we're already looking at communities that have disproportionate, you know, health disparities and other health issues that are really laboring under this intensified burden.
Well, and, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the ACEs study that was done by Kaiser in the 90s. It was a huge study about the impacts of childhood trauma on adult health, the health outcomes. And, you know, I mean, with the historical trauma that Native people have experienced, they do not, unfortunately, have projected good health outcomes, because they have a variety of compound trauma that they have, you know, experienced. And so it's not surprising that their life expectancy is shorter. There, I mean, we also have the problem of suicide.
Right. And Holly, I don't want to cut things short, but we only have a few minutes left, and I want to make sure that our listeners know what they can do to help and what you're trying to do right now in order to aid these tribal members that are really, you know, in this quite horrible and avoidable situation.
Yeah, definitely. So we are in the process, I am in the process right now of setting up the structure of a 501c3 for longer term needs, for legal representation, for paving the main road, larger concerns like that. But we also do have, I believe there is a website that's set up. Robin White was going to speak about that a little bit. People can go on to the website and find, keep up to date, yeah, and find out how they can help, how they can contribute. There is also, there was a link provided on the
I can break in and give them that. We're gonna run out of time. So the website is actnative.wordpress.com. So actnative.wordpress.com. So that should be live. If not, it will be shortly. We are looking for a nonprofit to umbrella us until that 501c is functional. We're also looking at some people from across the country. We're looking at making a kind of a native Red Cross or FEMA, if you will. If you get on that website, we'll be able to direct you to places to take donations to. Please, all new donations, no used clothing. We'll have lists on there of where you can purchase this stuff. We're working on getting a bulk buying deals with sourcing this stuff out and give you a little bit better idea what the long-term stuff is and trying to help legally and also working on what needs to be done later. So emergency supplies right now, but later fixing the roads, getting the dikes cleared out and the flood drainage done, and then fixing the houses as we're doing that. So it's complicated.
And we'll post that URL when we post the interview. I just also want to suggest that our listeners might want to call Governor Noem's office in South Dakota. The number there is 605-773-3212. And I want to thank our guest today. And we've unfortunately been unable to get Shelley Sanssouci on the phone, but we've been speaking with Holly St. Pierre, who's been our guest today. Thank you for speaking with us today, Holly.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. This has been Robin White and Desiree Helgers with the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Behind the world burn, seas rise and the clock turn, and the earth fighting back with hurricanes and the earthquakes and the pouring rain. This is for every life lost, for the legacy of standing rock, for the sacred land that we desecrate. The trauma my people so carry today, for the suicide of our youth, who so suffer from being colonized. Watch the bombs drop and the bullets fly. We steady ignoring the earth's cry. Past too many tipping points and there's not enough, running out of time. And the walls fall. How could you be a witness to the end and not act? Can't you see the world is broken? Every person on the planet, part of something bigger than us. We have all been chosen as a generation of humanity that determines what kind of world we will pass down to our children. I'm uncertain. How will you look your child in the eyes and tell them the future wasn't worth fighting for? Could have done more, but didn't listen. Didn't wake up, didn't speak up, didn't fight back when there was still time. Everything we love is what we must protect in the final moments while there's still time. And there is still time. There is still time.
This is KBOO Part 1, and you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That song was called Broken by Shutezcot Martinez. Shutezcot is an indigenous environmental activist, hip-hop artist, and youth director of Earth Guardians, a worldwide conservation organization. Finally on our program today, in a Left in the Law segment, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker review the bankruptcy case of PG&E underway in San Francisco. This investor-owned utility company, one of the largest in the United States, is defending itself and its stockholders in court in response to claims that they are facing around wildfires in Northern California that include loss of lives, forests, and people losing homes. Jan and Mike, look at who is really represented in these bankruptcy hearings.
In a recent article on Forbes magazine, Mark Paul and Johanna Bazua with the Democracy Collaborative call for public ownership of energy utilities as a vital part of responding to the climate crisis. Today we'll be talking about the movement for public power and specifically public takeover of PG&E, the California's largest utility that is in bankruptcy court and suffered a setback in court earlier this month. So let's talk about the competing claims before the judge. I don't think public ownership is on the docket when I read the docket. As an attorney, Mike, tell us what's going on with the bankruptcy proceedings.
Well, bankruptcy proceedings are all about money. And there are people who say that they cannot pay their debtors, and then there are the people to whom they owe money. Both have representation. In this
sad cases.
Well, there generally are sad cases. In this case, there are two gigantic corporate interests. One of them is PG&E itself, which really is the kind of corporation that gives capitalism a bad name. They're convicted felons. Their negligence led to an explosion in San Bruno, California, that killed 8 people. They were found guilty in 2016. They're on probation now. The judge recently said that PG&E, quote, pumped out $4.5 billion in profits and let the tree budget wither. They're famous for confiscating funds from ratepayers, ostensibly paid to justify capital improvements, to simply add to the profits, and so therefore propping up their stock prices.
So they, by giving capitalism a bad name, you mean they also expose the irrationalities of capitalism?
They absolutely do. They exploit every opportunity to beef up their stock price. That's their beginning and end of what they have been trying to do.
One of the claims, as I understand it, is that the company cannot meet its debts, and that proponents of victims and the public interest have said this is a, there's been kind of a misinformation campaign around that, or many victims are not submitting claims because they believe that the company has gone bankrupt. What does that even mean, to say they're bankrupt or to claim they're bankrupt, when they have massive assets still?
Well, we don't know. That's the purpose of this proceeding, to find out. What can they pay back? Now, the other side, the chief people on the other side of PG&E are bondholders, the people to whom PG&E own debts.
And can you just say the difference between a bondholder and a stockholder? Because these are terms used around the hearing, and what does it mean to be a bondholder in this context?
It means you have lent PG&E money. PG&E came to you 4 years ago and said, lend me $30 million. I'll pay you back at 6% on a quarterly basis. So a bondholder would be someone who's got $30 million and said, they've only paid me back $1 million. They owe me another $29 million.
And bonds are set at a certain rate that makes them stable, determined in advance to be stable investments with a low return, but predictable?
Well, sort of, yeah. They are predictable. Occasionally some bondholder goes bankrupt. But what's happened is that major capitalists see opportunity. They see that a law was recently passed that allows PG&E to impose future wildfire costs on ratepayers. So everybody is lined up, including Elliott Management is a bondholder now. Elliott has bought up all the bonds, and now they are a major player. And they are as despicable as any group of financiers has ever been. It's they who feed on the Argentinians now, because they bought up Argentinian debt and then persuaded a district court judge in New York to hold Argentina liable and prevent Argentina from dodging that debt. They confiscated a freighter in Liberia owned by Argentina. But they have now made friends with some of the victims as well as with the union. They're offering much more money to the victims.
The International fire. Brotherhood of Electrical Workers that yeah. has its own, I think, complicated role as a player in all of this. But there's kind of a alliance against a greater enemy, or there's an alliance of convenience around
all of that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's so you've got this big player, namely PG&E itself, battled against bondholders, debt holders, people to whom PG&E owes money, who have made an alliance with the union and with many of the victims. PG&E's chief concern, it says, is exaggerated and inflated claims by victims. They're hypersensitive to excessive claims and really indifferent to all the legitimate claims of people who were damaged on a large scale.
And then there's the public interest that doesn't weigh in or doesn't have standing in bankruptcy court, apparently, but for reasons that baffle me, because it seems to me that there should be claims that communities and states can make beyond people who have lost their lives or their property?
Well, that's supposed to be done by the Public Utilities Commission.
Oh.
Utilities are quasi-governed by people appointed by politicians, and PG&E has been very assiduous in developing good relationships with politicians. They gave $6 million last year to politicians. That's why they got this favorable law passed only 2 months ago. It was signed by Governor Newsom. They're a bipartisan group. They give money to literally everybody in Sacramento. So they get their way quite a bit, and they've made themselves into a juicy object, mangled, hurt, but large and potentially very profitable.
And are the bankruptcy hearings and the response to these recent blackouts that many scientists and engineers say were unnecessary and a very crude tool for dealing with as a fire prevention measure, is there in all this outrage an opportunity for politicians like Governor Newsom to express the appropriate horror and seem to be disciplining them but really doing nothing?
Oh, absolutely. There is a tremendous opportunity to do just that. The politicians have been railing away against PG&E, but the substantive work they've done has all been very supportive of the present PG&E governing body.
So this leaves it to community organizing. There are groups like the Clean Energy Alliance in the Bay Area and a number of groups calling for not only more accountability, but public ownership this utility.
There is accountability. There's a woman now in charge of the Public Utilities Commission who may be better than the people she's replaced, but structural reform is what's necessary. You can have public ownership of the transmission system, or they could buy the hydroelectric system. That would enable the state to reduce its cost-based rates. You'd eliminate dividends, shareholder returns, so that would reduce the cost of your debt when you borrow money, and it would reduce monthly bills.
It's a bit like the Medicare for All campaign. You can't just look at the rates of your premium. There are a lot of other issues around how expensive our healthcare system is because of people who just shuffle things around and are not really providing services, not doing preventive services. So it's not enough to just talk about premium rates, which I think has been a mistake of some of the Democrats. I think with here too, it's not just about the rates of your power, but how it's generated and the sustainability of it and how our power generation and transmission affects whole communities, particularly vulnerable communities.
Well, only public ownership could make determinations about power in the general public interest. Now, even a good that is responsible utility wants to increase, and that will require building centralized power generators. There's no premium in having local, like rooftop solar energy, all these kinds of more efficient transmission of energy does not help build the size of the company.
And their dividends.
And the size of their dividends.
Do you think the bankruptcy hearings play any potential role in this drama? They're apparently very dry. There's a bench ruling by a judge. Media aren't allowed in. I tried to find out whether there was a way media could come in. They're very restricted in terms of access to what's going on. What do you see the role of the bankruptcy hearings themselves in this call for a broader movement toward public power?
Well, it hasn't obvious opportunity for people who've been wounded by PG&E to speak for and be heard. It's true that you cannot send a representative in for the public, nor can you have media present, but you can talk to people after the day's hearings. And so long as an eye is kept closely on PG&E, that would make it tougher for politicians to then make the proper noises and then accept the checks wielded by PG&E and have the checks determine their behavior.
Do they have to then open up their books more carefully during a bankruptcy here? Or can they, is this one big shell game where they can shuffle stuff around and conceal the real level of their assets?
Well, in theory, that's why bankruptcy courts exist. You know, if you've got a donut shop and you claim in downtown Portland and you claim that you can't pay people back, you just are not, donuts have fallen out of favor, then people are going to say, no, you're getting more money. I saw a long line of donut eaters. There's going to be careful attention paid to how much money you're receiving and where that money goes. And this guy, Dennis Natale, the bankruptcy judge, has the skills and the staff to find out stuff about whether money has been stashed in a place where it's not being acknowledged, and how much money. He'll determine how much money the bondholders are truly entitled to, whether or not the validity of individuals who've had their houses burned, how much money they're each allowed to get. It's very bulky. It's a huge proceeding because so much damage was done to so many people. But
can they bet against what projected future earnings?
You bet. Yeah, they're going to claim minimize their future earnings. The bondholders are going to maximize their future earnings. And the judge is charged with deciding, you know, what's reasonable in light of all this evidence.
And they've been there before. They were in bankruptcy court in 2001, survived that and various felony charges. No one went to prison, as far as I know.
No one even resigned. It's amazing
how these smarmy characters end up on their feet. It is somewhat shocking, even for people who've been around a while.
It is. They are a sorry carcass of a company, and yet they remain very strong, like some sort of monster zombie lurching around. And they're now a really valuable organization, primarily due to these recent legal changes that have made it easy for PG&E to up the rates of ratepayers in order to cover any damages caused by their negligence.
Yeah. Okay, we'll keep... we'll keep following this, give the highlights and the lowlights of these hearings, and hopefully we'll have some kind of people power coming out of this.
Well, it should speed the movement, which in terms of climate change is really essential toward limiting the damage caused by the way the weather is moving.
This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the Movement for Public Power and the bankruptcy hearings underway in California with Pacific Gas and Electric.
Thank you, Jan and Mike. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kullberg has been our engineer. Thanks to our participants today, Bill Resnick and Lisa Loving on the importance of street journalism, Robin White and Desiree Helligers, and guest Holly St. Pierre for their report on flooding in the Acton Sioux Reservation, and Left in the Law commentators Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker for their analysis of the PG&E bankruptcy. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well, can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Moles' perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles to chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. This is KBOO Portland. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of this show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at omolevarietyhour, all one word, at gmail.com. Now stay tuned at 10 for Wokus Focus with Barbara Bernstein. At 11, it's First Voices Radio.